from Titan and the Urd station. Both outposts had apparently been abandoned but not attacked. Well, score one for a small dollop of sanity. Both Homer and I had had some small fantasy that there might have been humans still in the stations, but realistically, 30-odd years after the war, that would have been miraculous. As discussed, Homer set up a small auto factory at each find, just enough printers and roamers to produce a few cargo drones at a time. As they were produced, the cargo drones would start moving materials to the L4 and L5 points in the Earth-Moon system. Larger auto factories were already being set up at the two Lagrange points, initially to produce bobs and drones, and then to bootstrap up to the industrial-scale equipment necessary to build a full-sized colony ship. I sat back and massaged my eyes. Well, I've always wanted a challenge. When I left the solar system, when Bob 1 left the solar system, but it felt like my own memory, I thought I was done with humanity, except for the occasional radio message. Now, I was not only back to dealing with people, but I had thousands, if not millions, of lives riding on my actions. The old Pacinoism really nailed it. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. 30. Bob. April 2165, Delta Eridani. I walked slowly around the VR of the native encampment. Drones had taken enough high-quality footage that I was able to create a life-size replica of the actual village. I had no idea about the smells, so I just went with Earth equivalents. But the heat, humidity, and the texture of the plants and ground were all accurate. I watched the tribe members in their daily routines. They didn't react to my presence, since these were recordings, but it gave me a good feeling of scale and movement. I spent a few days observing the natives, whom I was starting to refer to as Deltans, both through live video and VR simulation and by listening to recordings of their speech. The Deltans seemed to have two genders, a tribal structure and loose pairing, by which I meant that certain Deltans seemed to prefer each other's company. There didn't really seem to be anything formal, and a couple of individuals were seeing multiple significant others. The males tended to hang out together, and the females and children formed the core of the tribe, or at least the center. It seemed to be closely analogous to how anthropologists believed that primitive humans were organized. In fact, the more I watched them, the more I realized how similar they were to primitive humanity. Was that because the environment naturally constrained behaviors, or was there something inevitable about the tribal structure? I hoped that we, the Bobs, that is, would eventually gather enough samples to form a theory, even if it took millennia. The Deltans seemed to have a high level of vigilance. There were always males on alert patrolling the edge of their territory. Weapons consisted of clubs, handheld rocks, and pointed sticks. I hadn't yet seen what they were guarding against. Other Deltans? Animals? Their vocalizations weren't particularly complex. Nothing like dolphins, thank goodness. By the 22nd century, we still couldn't talk to dolphins. I was slowly building a list of standard sounds and sound groups for the Deltan language. I hoped soon to have enough to do some analysis. Another batch of observation drones was delivered from the auto factory, which was both good and bad news for me. The good news was that I could set up permanent lines of sight for watching the Deltans, then send drones to other locations. The bad news was that overseeing all the moving drones was getting to be a strain. Replicant I might be, but I still could only concentrate on one thing at a time. I needed more Bobs. Lightbulb. Why not just do that? I could build the AI cores in advance of the vessels and set the other Bobs to monitoring various groups of drones. They wouldn't mind. I knew that they'd enjoy it because, well, Bob. Actually, no, I hoped they'd enjoy it because, Bob, it really wasn't a sure thing. I transmitted instructions to the auto factory to bump up priority of computer cores at the expense of vessel assembly. Fortunately, the standard templates included plans for cradles to hold disembodied cores. The Deltan female was cutting open the carcass of a prey animal that one of the males had brought back. This didn't seem like anything particularly special. In fact, I'd been cataloging her technique for a while before I realized that her sharp stone had a handle. This was special, as every other Deltan that I'd watched just held the naked stone. I was archiving all surveillance footage, so I ran a quick search of anything featuring this particular Deltan. It took only a few minutes to find the source of the tool. The female's, son? Male pup? Crap. Might as well just go with anthropomorphizing them. I know I'm going to anyway. Son it is. Anyway, the boy seemed to always be playing with something. In this case, he had split a branch using a sharp stone, stuck the stone into the split, then wrapped the stick with something unidentifiable. His identification was C.3.41, which placed him in Tribe C, Cohort 3, Member 41. Now he's Archimedes. I assigned a drone to stay on him 24/7. Well, 29/7 on Delta Eridani 4. Over the next few days, I kept careful tabs on Archimedes. He was always at something. While his peers were sitting around in the shade or engaged in games of tag, Archimedes walked around, picking up rocks and attempting to break them. I think he was looking for more rocks that made sharp edges, like the flint he'd made into a tool for his mother. There didn't appear to be any flint in the area, so the tools were at a premium. It made me wonder where the flint had come from, though. I set an explorer drone the task of finding the nearest exposed flint deposits.
Incoming call.
Hi, Bob, this is Marvin. I rematerialized my VR. Another Bob's image appeared in the holotank. Hi, Marvin, were you just booted up? That is correct, HIC-17378-1, since we're no longer numbering Bobs. Well, it does get a little hard to coordinate numbering between star systems. Welcome, Marvin. Pull up a drone. Things are getting interesting. I filled Marvin in on what had happened since the backup of mine that he was restored from. He immediately volunteered to look for the flint source. That made me feel better. At least one of them was interested enough to help. Over the next couple of days, two more Bobs came online. Luke and Bender were as enthusiastic about the project as Marvin and jumped right in. I spent a significant portion of my days watching Archimedes. When he slept, I took care of auto factory control and surveying other parts of DE-4.
Eden,
Bender said out of nowhere. What? Let's call it Eden, birthplace of humanity, birthplace of Deltans. I like it, I nodded. Marvin and Luke weren't in VR at the moment, but a quick IM to them netted positive comments. Eden it is. Cool. I turned back to the drone that was spying on Archimedes. I had finally discovered what he used for twine. It was a smallish vine that Archimedes would harvest, split into strands, and let dry on a rock. This result seemed to be quite tough, but still flexible. I didn't see anyone else in any of the tribes doing this, so I had to assume it was unique behavior. My God, the kid must be lonely. No one understands him, I bet. In fact, Archimedes seemed to spend most of his days alone, wandering around, poking at things. He was constantly working at something, either picking apart plants or smashing rocks, or smashing things on rocks, or digging in unlikely places. It was obvious to me that he was investigating and cataloging his world. He would have gotten no help from his parents. They and everyone else seemed to be in the pointy stick stage and quite satisfied with that. They weren't even straightening the sticks, so the things couldn't really be called spears. I sat back and sighed. This was so frustrating. I found myself wishing that I could go there, sit down with Archimedes, and show him a few things. Then I smiled as I realized I no longer saw a furry pig bat, just a lonely kid. 31. Riker, January 2158, Sol. This Federation of Planets Council session will come to order. I looked around at the three other Bobs in their video windows. After considerable negotiation with Colonel Butterworth, we'd settled on two new Bobs for now. I admit I was still a little miffed that the Colonel thought of us as a resource sink instead of an asset. I think you may be just a little too invested in this Star Trek thing, Charles said with a smirk. I waved away the comment. We've always been a Star Trek fan. Deal with it. I waited a moment for more flack, then continued. The scavenging auto factories are in full operation now. We're beginning to get a steady stream of materials into the Lagrange points, and I hope to have the actual shipyard auto factory up and running within 2 years. Meanwhile, Homer and Charles will continue to scour the system for mineral deposits, and Arthur and I will scan Earth for evidence of any other surviving groups. Questions? But even if we find groups, there isn't much we can do for them, is there? Charles was voicing a concern that we all shared. Without transport, we couldn't supply food or medicine to any group we might locate. The Heaven vessels were most definitely not designed to land or even to enter atmosphere. And even if we had transport, Colonel Butterworth had made it very clear that he wouldn't be accepting new refugees or providing food or medicine for them. We were on our own for any aid we might be able to give. My greatest fear right now was that I might find a group of people, then have to stand by helplessly and watch them die. After some discussion, Arthur and I decided to do polar orbits, scanning in orange slices. By staggering our passes, we would be able to cover the entire planet using the Sudar from orbit. Drones would follow up anything interesting with low-altitude visual inspections. The orbital survey wouldn't be able to detect people directly, of course, but any new construction, working power plants, or farming operations would flag a location for the drones to check out. It took about 2 weeks to finish the survey. At the end of it, we had a map of the Earth with almost 40 locations marked, half a dozen cities, and a lot of smaller enclaves. Arthur's image in the video link looked tired. He closed his eyes and rubbed his forehead slowly. 15 million people. From 12 billion down to 15 million. As a species, we're morons. Maybe we should just let them die and start over. Wow, you really are a morose bugger, aren't you? Arthur seemed to have inherited a greater-than-average dollop of gloominess, and he was getting old. I'd been biting back my retorts, but was running out of self-control. I actually found myself thinking of swapping his assignment with Homer. The big problem, I continued with a gesture toward the globe, is that we can't possibly move that many people, even if the other Bobs find enough habitable planets. The colony ships designed by the USE can handle 10,000 people at a time, stacked like cordwood in stasis pods. That's 1,500 ships, or 1,500 trips, either way. Not going to happen. Arthur nodded. So we get to pick who is most deserving. Christ's sake, Eeyore, get a grip. We pick based on need, based on which groups need rescuing the most. What else can we do? The USC group doesn't fit that requirement. Needs-wise, they're in an above-average position. Yeah, I know, I sighed. But we did agree to help them, and they did supply the plans and a lot of intel. I think we're obligated regardless. What we can do is move some of the more needy groups to the USC's installation after we've shipped them out. That should help. Sure, we'll stuff them in the back with the busters, no prob. I turned to face Arthur, ready to snap at him, and realized he had a point. I bit back what I'd been about to say and thought for a moment. We're going to need transport vessels. We'd eventually need them anyway, but this makes them a priority. Better adjust the manufacturing schedule. The Colonel will have a fit. The Colonel was having a fit. I'd never seen Butterworth actually angry before. He did angry with a smoldering understatement that was very effective.
Are you sure you've done project planning before, Riker? Because I'm seeing slippage almost every day, it seems. One would almost think you're making this up as you go along.
Well, I kind of am doing exactly that, Colonel. Project planning isn't about avoiding changes, it's about controlling them. No project plan ever survives contact with the enemy. A ghost of a smile flashed across the Colonel's face before he recovered control.
I think you may be misremembering that quote, Riker. In any case, I'm fine with moving any refugees into our compound once we've departed. I hope that will give you some motivation to get us out sooner.
As if I needed more motivation. Riker out. I shut down the channel, sat back, and stared into space. I liked the Colonel, really. But dealing with him often felt a lot like dealing with, me. He was stubborn, opinionated, and able to support his stance with good, solid arguments, which just made my job more difficult. I looked over the map again, not because I expected to glean any new information, more as a kind of nervous tic that I seemed to have developed. We had completed a secondary survey, looking for any small groups that we might have missed on the first sweep, but after 30 years of war and planetary bombardment, small groups would have either consolidated or died. The refugee groups were scattered around the planet and represented pretty much every nation in existence when the war started. That wasn't going to make things any easier. If anything, xenophobia would be even stronger. I probably wouldn't be able to just dump everyone on one planet and expect them to get along. I'd given Arthur the task of contacting each enclave. So far, it was proving more difficult than expected. Time for a status check. I called Arthur. His image appeared immediately. How are things going, Arthur? He popped up a status window for me. Arthur might be a bit of a downer, but he had exceptional discipline. I've already completed about half of the communicators that we need and delivered 25% of them, or tried to. Several of our drones have been shot down on approach, and a half dozen communicators were simply smashed as soon as the drone left. Not everyone wants to talk to us, as it turns out. I guess I can see it. People who have lived through the last 30 years are going to be a bit on the distrustful side. I shook my head sadly. I'd already decided that I wasn't going to kidnap people or march them into a cargo bay at gunpoint. Anyone who wanted to opt out could stay on Earth. Colonel Butterworth agreed wholeheartedly, although I had a feeling that had more to do with reducing what he saw as distractions. So, have you gotten past introductions with anyone? Not yet, no. Arthur shrugged. Standard explanation delivered by recorded video. Very few original questions in response. A lot of verbal abuse. Pretty routine. He popped up another window. Hey, by the way, got a report from Homer. Well, we were talking and he filled me in. They've identified more than enough resources system-wide to build 3 ships. Almost enough for a 4th, although some of the stuff is pretty far out in the outer system. I nodded. I'd received a report from Homer and had skimmed it. I'd actually been hoping to be able to build at least a half dozen ships, but I didn't want to give Arthur another reason to get all glum on me. Not that he needed much in the way of reasons, but it was progress. 32. Bill, October 2158, Epsilon Eridani.
Communication received from Milo.
Right on time, I grinned at Guppy. Predictably, he returned a fishy poker face. I wonder if he found Vulcans.
Not quite.
I raised an eyebrow. That was a far cry from the flat no that I'd normally expect from Guppy. If he responded at all, now my curiosity was way up. I'd been deep into one of my pet projects, creating realistic artificial bodies. The ultimate problem was producing a muscle analog that worked, looked, and generally acted similar enough to the natural thing. Gears, pistons, and cables would never produce a workable android. I forced myself to close the project folder, invoked a coffee, kicked off a goose that had settled into my lawn chair, and sat down. Spike ambled over, ignoring the angry goose, and set up shop in my lap. Okay, Guppy, let's see it. Milo's report spread before me in midair. System schematics, close-ups of the twin planets, 2 habitable planets, and biological analysis. I chuckled at his insistence on naming them. I'd have done the same. Probably would have picked the same names, come to that. I sat back, staring into space, so preoccupied that I stopped patting Spike. I was reminded of my primary duty by a furry head butting against my chin. Sorry, Your Highness, I smiled at the cat, and resumed justifying my existence. 2 planets, in a system that was generally considered a marginal candidate for any habitable planets. Were the astrophysicists wrong? Granted, so far we only had 3 data points, including Earth, but that's 3 out of 3. If you were willing to be generous with Ragnarok. Well, first things first. I queued up the report to be forwarded to Earth just in case Milo hadn't sent a copy that way. Hopefully Riker would be listening. That left the million-dollar question, which was whether there was anyone left back at Sol to take advantage of this. I was periodically transmitting the plans for the Scut to every system within 30 light-years, just in case there was a Bob there at some point, but the first transmission to Sol wouldn't arrive for another 9 years or so. I was going to be chewing my nails for a while, looked like. I pinged Garfield. Hey, Gar, have you read the latest from Milo? He popped into my VR and pointed at his face. Does this look boggled enough? We shared a laugh, and he continued. It's awesome. We have a place to put people. Assuming there are still people. Garfield grimaced. That would be just the kind of sick joke the universe likes to play. Let's hope not this time. I nodded. Yippers, you know, it's funny. When I left Earth, I just wanted to get away from humanity. Now I find myself acting like some kind of, I don't know, shepherd or something. How does the old joke go? I like people in the abstract, but not in the concrete. Well, we'll know in a few years. Meanwhile, how's the Kuiper mapping going? Garfield popped up a schematic. Because of the time required to get a chunk of ice from the Kuiper to Ragnarok, we were taking the time to look for the biggest chunks. The extra effort up front would pay off later. Most chunks seemed to be too small to bother with, but Gar had found a couple of good icebergs and dropped beacons on them. I still hadn't quite decided how I was going to get them moving in the right direction. 33. Riker, March 2158, Seoul. Final count, 15 million people. The entire human species represented in a two-page list. That was definitely a downer, and Arthur was not letting the opportunity pass him by. We're not going to be able to get them all off planet, you know. Arthur shook his head, eyes downcast. I wondered if he was really sad or reveling in the irony. I sat back, put an arm over the back of my chair, and gazed at him in silence until he stopped. Arthur. Yes. Please shut the hell up. Arthur gave me a half grin and a shrug by way of response. You know I'm right. Yes, and you were right the last 25 times you said it. Are you keeping score? Arthur shrugged and, without another word, popped up the latest construction status report. Ah, blessed silence at last. Just the same, I couldn't really blame him. We'd accounted for every group of people larger than about 100 on the planet with very high confidence. It seemed very likely that groups smaller than that simply couldn't survive or had seen the advantages of joining larger groups. There'd definitely been consolidation. A few locations actually had a higher population now than they had pre-war. About half of the global population was currently living in New Zealand, Madagascar, and, strangely, Florianopolis, Brazil. The two island nations made sense. They hadn't really been part of any conflict and didn't represent strategic targets. Their populations were way down, but their climates were still mild enough to maintain the current numbers. Florianopolis was a weird one. Most of South America was a blasted, jagged moonscape. Between Brazil pounding their neighbors and China pounding Brazil, there was very little livable land left, but for some reason the southern tip of Brazil had been spared. It was likely that the population had been augmented by refugees coming in from other areas. The rest of the global population was scattered around the planet. A lot of people had ended up in island clusters, such as the Maldives, French Polynesia, Marshall Islands, and so forth. Again, probably not prime targets, and their climates would be comfortable for the longest. Then there were the marginal locations, such as Spitsbergen Island, San Diego, Okinawa, and the USE enclave outside Augsburg, Germany. It seemed likely that a lot of the current populations had migrated there over time, and mortality must have been significant for the first couple of years. It would be our job to keep them alive. I hadn't discussed it yet with the others, but I'm sure it had occurred to them. 15 million people couldn't be moved off-planet in any reasonable time, even if we had a destination. Most of these people would have to be kept alive on Earth. And according to the Colonel, over the last decade or so, the climate had begun to degrade significantly. Each year had less sunlight, lower temperatures, more snow. The ice caps and glaciers were growing again, for the first time since the 1600s. Spitsbergen in particular probably didn't have more than 5 years left, even given their innovative adaptations. Our current projections, admittedly rough, showed the Earth completely encased in glaciers within 50 to 100 years. I looked over at Arthur. He knew what I was thinking, and he didn't have to say anything. At least he had the decency not to gloat. Okay, Arthur, I get it. We have to organize these groups and try to get some cooperation. How are you doing with communication? Arthur gave one of his rare smiles. The drive-in movie-sized holographic presentation helped a whole bunch. People couldn't turn it off or smash it, so they had to listen. The next time we dropped off a communicator, we got almost no breakages or assaults. I think we still only have 5 places that won't accept contact, and they're not big. And they'll probably join once they find out everyone else has. Good. Let me know when everything is tested and ready, and we'll issue invitations to the first meeting of the new United Nations. I don't know what could possibly have made me think this was a good idea. I sat with my elbow on the armrest, forehead in my hand, while the delegates displayed complete contempt for Robert's rules of order. At any moment, at least a half dozen people were yelling into their cameras, trying to drown out the others. 38 different video windows displaying miniature, gesticulating, yelling dervishes floated in the air before me. It would be funny if the fate of the world wasn't resting on this group. Every candidate had the same view as myself, and yet not one was cringing with embarrassment. Oh, there was some consensus, so it wasn't a complete loss. For instance, many groups hated the idea that the USE enclave would be getting off planet first, even though the USE had been the first to contact us and supplied the plans for the colony ships. Even more groups were incensed at the Spitsbergen group's demand that they be given priority because of their tenuous situation. And everybody was beyond apoplectic that the Brazil group was even allowed in. Brazil was generally considered to have started the war, and everyone was holding a grudge. Couldn't say I entirely disagreed, but most of the people in Florianopolis were under the age of 10 when the war started, if they had been born at all. Nevertheless, Brazil. I looked over at Homer's video feed. He had fallen over, laughing. I spared him a small smile. Over the last little while, I'd started to understand where Homer's humor was coming from. He was laughing less at the people themselves than the utter ridiculousness of the situation. When push came to shove, he'd give his all to help. I decided I'd given them enough rope, time to rein things in. I pressed the override button. Immediately, every delegate's microphone was cut off. Every communicator emitted a loud air horn sound, and every video feed switched to an image of me. Ladies and gentlemen, and I use those terms loosely, we're done for the day. We'll be signing in tomorrow at the same time, but with shiny new rules. Your microphones will only be active when the chairperson, that's me for the moment, recognizes you. If you'd like the other members to watch you having a fit in pantomime, that's fine too. Let me say up front that I don't care if you don't like it. Good night. I hit the end button, and all sessions were closed. I leaned back in my chair with a groan, while Homer climbed back into his and tried to catch his breath.
Wow, number two, that was intense. Those are some thoroughly pissed off people.
I waved a hand in dismissal. On the one hand, Homer, these are people fighting to get into a lifeboat while the ship sinks. I can sympathize. On the other hand, their behavior is not helping things along.
They're just passengers, Riker, Homer said in a serious tone. They feel helpless. They feel like their fate is being decided by someone else without their input. You need to give them something to do, some way to contribute, some way to feel like they're controlling their destiny at least a little bit.
Huh. That was actually very perceptive. And my opinion of Homer took another small ratchet upwards. My handling of the situation, truthfully, had probably been less than ideal, but this didn't resemble any job description I'd ever had. Homer began to pace, something I don't think I'd ever seen.
Look, Riker, you have to ease up on them. These people are scared, and you aren't giving them any reason to believe that you care about their concerns. You aren't actually the Star Trek character, you know. You need to loosen up a little.
Christ's sake, Homer, you actually think 15 million people are going ballistic because I don't smile enough? I get it about them being scared, but their reactions are their responsibility, not mine. You want to do a comedy routine? Feel free. Bring back your cartoon avatar. That should be good for some laughs. Or not. When you're done, they'll still be at each other's throats, and maybe we can go back to trying to actually fix things. Homer stared at me for a few moments, then shook his head and disappeared. Okay, maybe I'd laid it on a little thick. And I probably owed him an apology, but I just didn't have time for this. The chair recognizes the delegate from Maldives. A green light came on over the delegate's image, and she visibly made an effort not to adjust her clothing.
Mr. Riker, we do not appreciate your high-handed actions yesterday.
She berated me for several minutes. Typical politician, never use 10 words when 1,000 will do. I waited patiently until she was done, then took the floor. Representative Sharma, I didn't enjoy shutting you down yesterday any more than I enjoy chairing these meetings in general. I'd like the delegates to self-police, but at the same time, there are decisions that must be made in a timely manner. You don't have the luxury of a free-for-all, so here's the thing. I want you, as in the assembly, to decide how a chairperson will be picked, whether they'll have control over the microphones and so on. Once that's done, I will sit back and be just another delegate. How does that sound? There was stunned silence for a moment. Then everyone started talking at once. Then another moment of stunned silence as they realized I'd turned on all the microphones, followed by general laughter. When order had been restored, the delegate from the Maldives, still smiling, said,
"Point well taken, Mr. Riker. Leave it to us. We'll hammer something out."
I nodded to her and took myself offline. I looked at my call queue. A 12 calls from various delegates awaited me. Wonderful. The first was from the Faith Enclave in San Diego. I really didn't know what to expect. It was generally known that I was a Faith interstellar probe, but I'd been going to great lengths to make it clear that I was a sentient, independent entity. Well, only one way to find out.
"Good day, Minister Cranston. What can I do for you?"
"Good day, Replicant. I wanted to talk to you about your duty."
"It's Riker, and I'm very aware of my duty. I have 15 million people depending on me. That's never very far from my mind."
"You have a duty to Faith, over and above that. You were built by us. You owe your existence to us. I expect to see our group get a more favorable treatment in the future."
Wow, dude was blunt, anyway. I hadn't been looking forward to the typical dancing-around-the-point conversation that people called diplomacy. I guess this was better. Sort of.
"Not going to happen, Minister."
"That's not your decision, Replicant."
"Well, actually it is. That's what comes from being an independent, sentient entity, and you might want to work on your social skills. Good day, Minister." Before he could respond, I cut off the connection. The next one was from the leader of the Spitsbergen Island Refuge. This would be a difficult conversation. The Spitz Enclave would very likely be the first place to become uninhabitable.
"Good day, Mr. Walter."
Gudmund Walter blinked owlishly at the video. Ex-military, he had an abrupt style that would have sunk him in traditional politics, but that was well-suited for this post-apocalyptic world.
"Good day, Mr. Riker. I, of course, am calling to press the case for my people. You have hopefully by now received our food production projections for the winter upcoming. It is not well, not well at all."
"I know, Mr. Walter, and I reiterate that I will not let people starve. However, bumping your group up in the emigration queue isn't the answer. That's still maybe a decade off. We should be concentrating on more short-term solutions."
"Hope is part of that short-term solution, sir. We can hold on if we know there is an end in the sight. At the moment, most of my people expect to be dead one way or another before our turn comes."
I pinched the bridge of my nose and sighed. The Spitz were a relatively small group, perhaps 4,000 people who had managed to survive on the island of Spitsbergen. Their techniques were impressive, involving intensive agriculture during the Arctic summers, combined with seal hunting and reindeer herding to provide enough calories. But the deteriorating climate was making their job harder every year. They might have another decade or two, at most, before it became impossible.
"Mr. Riker, have you knowledge of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault and the Svalbard Global Genetic Diversity Vault?"
The name was familiar. I did a quick library dive. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault had been built in 2008, which was why I'd heard of it. It was intended as a backup seed bank for other national seed banks. According to the library, in 2025, the Svalbard Trust had expanded the mandate of the Seed Vault to include all species of plant, domesticated or not, from dandelions to sequoias. They'd also established the Genetic Diversity Vault to store animal genetic material. I was stunned.
and sat frozen for almost 100 milliseconds. This was huge, and Valter knew it. The viability of a colony would increase tremendously with even a fraction of what was in those vaults. Assuming they were still there. Valter wouldn't have noticed my hesitation at the human timescale. Yes, I'm familiar with it from the historical records, sir. Is it still in existence?
It is, sir. Unlike, I would imagine, most of the other vaults around the planet. We did not get rocks and nuclear weapons dropped on us.
So... I was pretty sure there was a punchline coming.
So the utility is obvious for colonists. We have it. You need it. Unless you can find one of the other vaults. Think on that, Mr. Riker. Assume any implied threat you care to. We will discuss this further in a few days upcoming.
And with that, Mr. Valter nodded to me, reached forward out of frame, and ended the connection. Well, that was one fine pickle. I looked at the remaining calls still on hold. I couldn't see any that needed immediate handling, so I instructed Guppy to take a message from each and to promise that I would phone them back. Guppy made an excellent secretary/receptionist. His appearance was off-putting enough so that people didn't stay online long, and he was absolutely unfazed by bullying, threats, bribery, or insults. Great poker face, too. I sent out a connection request to Colonel Butterworth. This was going to be one of those good news, bad news things. 34. Homer, September 2158, Sol.
My God, what a putz. Of course Riker was having problems with the Enclaves. The man was a humorless, rigid martinet with a pole up his butt. Every time he opened his mouth, he offended someone. Original Bobbitt always made a point of mocking people who took themselves too seriously. It amazed me that Riker wasn't able to make the connection. It was obvious that I was more like Original Bob than he was. And now the Spitz had delivered an ultimatum. Okay, that was a real problem, and I couldn't blame Mr. Pooh for getting bent out of shape about it, but there had to be a better tactic than frontal assault. I paced around my VR, hands behind my back, for a few milliseconds. Bet Riker does this. The thought made me shudder. I popped up a Nerf basketball in a hoop and began taking shots while I pondered. I noted idly that the trajectory of the basketball wasn't realistic. Yeah, the VR needs work. Who has time? Valter demanded a place for his people on the first ships, but did he really need to be on the first ships, or did he just want to be out early? What would be acceptably early? I pulled up the manufacturing schedule and gazed at it. You know, ship 3 isn't that far behind 1 and 2, and with some adjustments. The thought had possibilities, but Riker would just dismiss the idea out of hand if I brought it up. Did he even realize what an arrogant ass he had turned into? He listened to Colonel Butterworth, though. Yeah, that's the ticket. Smiling to myself, I made a call.
35. Bob, July 2165, Delta Eridani. The Deltans are under attack. I looked up at the call from Marvin. I'd been checking in with the auto factory to make sure everything was on track. Quickly, I suspended the autofactory link and brought up all Deltan feeds to the foreground. A group of what looked sort of like the natives was attacking one of the tribal hearths. Most of the males were off hunting, and the few that had been left to guard were having a hard time of it. The attackers were similar to the Deltans the same way a gorilla is similar to a human, both in size and strength. They didn't employ weapons at all, just teeth, claws, and overwhelming aggression. I watched in horror as one of the attackers ripped open the throat of a defender with its teeth. The gorilloids concentrated on taking down individuals. They didn't seem to be trying to take over the encampment or steal anything. As a Deltan was taken down, several gorilloids would drag the body away, fighting over it. I started to have a really bad feeling. The attack was over in a couple of minutes. One gorilloid had been killed when enough Deltans managed to get pointed sticks into it, but 6 Deltans were gone. In a war of attrition, the gorilloids would win. I ordered one of the drones to follow the gorilloids. They headed into the dense forest and split up, each group dragging a Deltan body. There didn't seem to be any organization. In fact, the longer I watched them, the more certain I was that there was nothing more than animal intelligence there. When the drone caught up with one of the groups, I found them tearing the body of the Deltan apart and eating it. I hadn't felt that ill since I died. I looked around in my VR. The other Bobs had been following the whole thing. I noticed that Marvin looked especially upset, and I raised my eyebrows at him. He looked around at the rest of us and shrugged. This kind of explains what I've found while I've been looking around. I've discovered a number of abandoned Delton camps, and the farther they are from the current camp, the longer it's been since they were abandoned. I think the gorilloids have been hunting the Deltons for a long time, and the gorilloids are winning. Luke piped up. Bender and I have been venturing farther afield, and we haven't found any other large tribes of Deltons. We've run into occasional small family groups, but they're nomadic and inhabiting marginal territory.
So they're being hunted to extinction, I said.
There were several seconds of silence before Bender spoke up, probably trying to be funny.
Remember the Prime Directive.
Luke looked at him in disgust. Right, when people show up in 100 years and we have to explain to them that they missed meeting the only other sentient race we've ever found by less than a century, I'm sure they'll be mollified by the knowledge that we didn't break a fictional law from a TV show.
Bender turned away, upset, and Luke seemed surprised at his outburst.
Sorry.
Marvin looked over at me. It's a fair question, though. How much exactly are we going to interfere, Prime Directives notwithstanding? There are real examples from Earth history of cultural contamination and outright extinguishment.
I consider it a given that we're not going to let them die out, I answered, looking down at my hands. For some reason, I couldn't keep them still.
Anxiety?
I don't have an answer beyond that, Marvin.
What are we going to do, though? Set up armed drones around the perimeter, become some kind of sky god that protects them?
Marvin looked from one person to the next, waiting for an answer.
Luke spoke up before I could respond.
This is the type of environmental pressure that forces swift evolution. In fact, they may be becoming intelligent specifically because of the gorilloids. Maybe we have to let nature take its course.
I turned to Guppy, who as usual was standing at parade rest over to the side.
I think I caught him by surprise, and I was positive that I had detected active interest in his expression and posture before he quickly went into fishy poker face.
Guppy, what's the total population of Deltons at the campfire sites?
412, allowing for today's deaths.
I turned back to the group.
That's down below estimates of the low point for humanity back in Africa. I don't think we have any leeway to just let things go.
So we're back to guarding them with drones, Bender said.
They're at the rock and pointy stick stage. That's not good enough to hold off the gorilloids.
Not all of them, I countered. You've seen Archimedes. That kid is smart.
Marvin pulled up a map.
Speaking of which, sort of, I found the flint source. One of the old villages, and interestingly, there's some worked flint there and in a couple of villages nearby. I think at least some of the Deltons have known what to do with it, so Archimedes isn't unique.
Marvin looked around at us to make sure we would get his next comment.
I think there's a recessive gene for increased intelligence that's spreading through the population. It just needs the opportunity to be expressed in every sense of the word.
I nodded. Let's give them that chance. Take a couple of drones, pick up some flint, and we'll drop it in the area where Archimedes normally hangs out. Let's see what happens.
There was a lot of wailing and growling when the hunting parties came back to camp that evening. The Deltons obviously understood death. We didn't know yet how they handled their dead since the gorilloids had taken the bodies. One of the hunters seemed especially broken up and was curled up on the ground shaking. I checked the records and, yep, he spent a lot of his downtime with one of the Deltons that had been killed.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting personally involved. Sue me.
I decided right there and then that I didn't like the gorilloids.
I've got something for you, Marvin said, interrupting my thoughts. I looked up at the schematic floating in my holotank. It showed plans for an observation drone that had been reinforced internally and given 20-pound steel caps at each end. A sort of personnel buster. Even with the modest acceleration capabilities of the drones, they could probably deliver a punch equivalent to a cannonball. Whether the drone would survive was an unknown.
I guess railguns weren't an option? I asked.
No! Even ignoring the complexity of the loading system, the surge drive in the drones just can't support enough acceleration to make a small caliber missile dangerous.
I sighed, and for the umpteenth time wondered if I should reconsider my policy on explosives.
And for the umpteenth time, I decided not to. I can produce a dozen of these in a few days if we bump all the other stuff, Marvin added. It's not an ideal solution, but it is a quick one to implement. As Senior Bob, decisions about manufacturing priorities were up to me. I thought about it for a few milliseconds, then nodded my head. We weren't on a schedule for launching Heaven vessels, so screw it. I wasn't going to let even one more Deltan get killed by the gorilloids if I could help it. It took Archimedes a couple of days to find the flint. We had dropped the nodules where we figured he'd happen upon them, but it's not as if he had a regular route. He wandered like any normal kid and was just as likely to walk in circles or sit on a rock for half a day playing with something. As soon as Archimedes saw the nodules, he jumped forward and picked them up. He then put them down, did a little jig, and searched the immediate area for any more. When he was satisfied that he had found all there were to find, he came back, grabbed them, and headed back toward his camp. He got maybe 50 feet, then stopped and looked down at his load. Marvin and I glanced at each other, perplexed. After a few moments, Archimedes headed off at an angle toward an outcropping that was one of his favorite hangouts. Once there, he hid all of the nodules except one in a crevice, then covered it with dead branches.
Eden, you said? I laughed. Looks like we've invented greed.
Marvin grinned. Or caution. I bet Flint is valuable. He might be worried about being mugged. Taking a single flint nodule, Archimedes walked back to camp and took a circuitous route to get to his mother. When he arrived, he set up with a couple of rocks to try to split the flint. We chuckled at the deliberate, studied casualness that he was trying to affect. It was so overdone that he might as well have been wearing a hat with a flashing red light. Before he'd even struck the first blow, several adult Deltans had come over. There was a loud exchange, and one of the adults tried to grab the nodule. Archimedes' mother jumped in, and the discussion got heated. Within seconds, a dozen or so Deltans were involved. At least half of them were yelling at any time, and pointy sticks were being waved. However, the floor seemed to be about evenly divided between those who wanted to take the nodule and those who suggested it would be over someone's dead body. Archimedes huddled at his mother's feet while she showed her teeth to anyone who got too close. Finally, things calmed down. Deltans stood around eyeing each other while another individual was fetched. I could see that he was older. It looked like age was age, whatever planet you lived on. His fur was going gray, and he was stooped. His muscle tone was poor, so he moved slowly. Another point for these people, they care for their elderly. The elder unwrapped some tools from a leather skin, sat with Archimedes, and patiently showed him how to split the flint. Now that was interesting. There was existing flint technology that hadn't been lost. This contraction of Deltan populations had to have been quick and recent. Many of the Deltans who had been involved in the yelling match went running off. They soon came back with items such as extra pointy sticks, dead animals and chunks of meat, something that looked like some kind of tuber, and other less identifiable things. With a start, I realized they were prepared to trade for the flint. I put both hands to my face and started to laugh. We'd just made Archimedes rich. The trading frenzy was over, and people had left with flints of various sizes. Archimedes' mother was going over the spoils. She had an expression involving wide eyes and erect ears that I tentatively identified as a smile analog. Looks like they'll be eating well for a few days. Archimedes had a haul of his own. He'd gotten several pointy sticks, a flint knife that had lost its edge, and all the flint flakes that were too small to be usable. Most importantly, the elder had shown him how to nap the flint. I watched him examine his treasures, and I could just hear the gears turning. Archimedes spent most of the rest of the day trying to put a new edge on the flint knife he'd received in trade. From the look of it, he didn't do a half-bad job. The kid was a quick learner, for sure. He took his prize to the elder, who I decided to name Moses for no good reason that I could think of. Moses looked at the result and nodded in approval. Okay, he actually did kind of a circle thing with his head, but it had the same meaning. He spent an hour showing Archimedes how to get the last bits sharpened. The next day, Archimedes snuck out to his stash and pulled out one of the other flint nodules. He had the napping tools that the elder had given him. He turned the nodule over and examined it for almost a half hour without actually doing anything with it. It was pretty obvious that he had something in mind and didn't want to screw it up.
I watched with great interest, and I sensed Marvin watching over my shoulder, VR-wise. Finally, Archimedes got to work. It took maybe 10 minutes before we could see what he was trying for. He had split the nodule left of center, then right of center on the bigger half. He was trying to extract the biggest flake he could. I decided he was probably going for a hand axe. Over the next several hours, Archimedes slowly and deliberately converted the large core into a quite workable hand axe. He then cleaned up his area, carefully hiding all the useful flint pieces in his stash, and headed off with his new tool. It turned out the point of the axe was to cut more saplings for pointy sticks. It made sense once I thought about it. Green wood, or whatever this stuff was, wouldn't be easy to cut without something hard and sharp. It was beginning to look like the loss of their flint source had been a major blow for the Deltans, perhaps one they hadn't thought about at the time, or they would have protected that site more aggressively. While cutting the third sapling, Archimedes had a misfire and attempted to chop the tree with his hand instead of the axe. The hopping around and verbalizations were really very human-looking, and to my shame, I laughed a little. Afterward, Archimedes kicked the tree and said something monosyllabic. I marked that as an F-bomb analog, and I don't mean maybe. Archimedes finished cutting down the third sapling, but I could see that his heart wasn't in it. His swings were tentative, and he hesitated on each one. As soon as he had it down, he took the three saplings back to his work area, set them down, and went back to camp. The next day, he was back in his work area. He had brought some of his twine with him. I watched in fascination and mounting excitement as he proceeded to split one of the saplings and tie the hand axe into it. Once he was done, he tried it out on a nearby tree. The first attempt was spectacularly unsuccessful. The axe acted like one of those tennis ball launchers you buy to throw a ball for your dog, with the axe blade playing the part of the tennis ball. Archimedes threw the now empty stick down, reinforced my conclusion about the F-bomb analog, and stomped off to look for his blade. I took a few moments to check with the Auto Factory AMIs. There were no problems on that front. The vessels for Marvin, Luke, and Bender were almost complete. I felt a moment of anxiety. It was great having company, especially given the nature of our shared project. I half hoped one or more of them would decide to hang around instead of taking off for the stars. Archimedes had found the tennis ball, hand axe, and was reattaching it to the stick, grumbling away in Deltan. I carefully cataloged the monologue. Very likely there were a lot of scatological and sexual references in there, and learning to swear in any language is always interesting. His second attempt was better, in that the axe blade didn't take off for parts unknown. But the stick had been intended for a spear, well, a pointy stick, and was too thin to serve as an axe handle. It bounced, rebounded, and twisted in his hand with every swing. Muttering darkly, Archimedes lay down the hand axe and stalked off. He came back in a few minutes with a more robust handle, sat down, and went through the whole mounting sequence. This time, when he tried it, the axe produced a very gratifying thunk, and wood chips flew. Archimedes gave a whoop that needed no translation and finished cutting down the sapling. He spent the rest of the afternoon gathering suitable specimens. I noticed that his selections were considerably straighter than most of the weapons used by the Deltans, and I wondered if this was because of greater discernment on his part, or if they'd simply been making do with what they could find. In any case, Archimedes' return to the camp caused a near riot. Interestingly, Archimedes took a couple of token items in exchange, but mostly just gave away the pointy sticks to the biggest Deltans. This not only placed them in his debt, but also ensured that the gorilloids would be given the warmest welcome possible on their next visit. Damn, that kid is smart. I jumped a little. I'd been so wrapped up in what Archimedes was doing that I'd forgotten all about Marvin. Yeah, he's going to own the place by the time he's full grown, I said, and hopefully he'll have lots of opportunity to spread his genes. I can't say that I looked forward to the next gorilloid attack, but I did look forward to the gorilloids maybe getting their asses kicked. I noticed over the next week that the Deltans seemed to be eating better. Better cutting tools meant more tubers with less work, and better pointy sticks meant better hunting results. The Deltons seemed to particularly favor something that I would consider a large, wild pig analog with the same general feeding habits and sunny disposition. It took a half dozen Deltons to bring one down, but the carcass would feed 20 or so Deltons for several days. Good return on effort. Part of their strategy involved bracing the butt of the pointy stick against the ground or a rock or tree and letting the charging pigoid impale itself. Since the pigoids never seemed to learn, it was a dependable source of food. The new, straighter pointy sticks did a much better job and resulted in dinner with less effort overall. Meanwhile, Archimedes had risen significantly in stature. He and his mother were now closer to the campfire, and the other juveniles were deferring to him. In fact, since Archimedes seemed to be pretty close to puberty, from what I could tell, some of the female juveniles were giving him a whole lot of attention. Way to go, kid. Then came the day I'd been both looking forward to and dreading, another gorilloid attack. By now, Archimedes had armed everyone with the good pointy sticks, and the improved hunting prospects meant more adult males stayed home to guard. A small group of gorilloids appeared out of nowhere and attacked Group E. The Delton females and cubs scattered, and the gorilloids seemed to somehow agree on a couple of specific victims to concentrate on. The gorilloids chased their chosen prey in groups of three. I noted in passing that they had chosen adult females rather than cubs, maybe because the cubs were quicker or perhaps because they provided less meat. One of the female targets ran right through a pack of approaching males with the gorilloids hot on her heels. The Deltons stopped, rammed the butts of their pointy sticks in the ground, and stood fast with as much courage as any medieval pikeman facing a cavalry charge. The effect was every bit as dramatic as I could have hoped for. The two leading gorilloids each took a couple or three sticks right in the chest. They were lifted into the air as their momentum converted to leverage on the sticks. As they hung suspended in the air for a moment, the gorilloids let out ear-piercing screams of agony. They came down to earth as their momentum reversed and fell over, still screaming. Although their huge arms still made them dangerous, the gorilloids were obviously badly wounded and couldn't get up. The Deltons fell upon them with pointy sticks, and within seconds, the screaming had stopped. The third gorilloid of the group got a rush of common sense to the head and made for the trees. The other group of three gorilloids had caught their intended victim but stopped when their compatriots started to scream. Now the Deltons, flush with their victory, rushed headlong toward the second group of gorilloids, yelling what were probably battle cries. The gorilloids were momentarily frozen with beastly astonishment, but finally managed to figure out that something was different. Dropping their victim, they sprinted for the forest, empty-handed, in full rout. The Deltons followed them to the edge of the camp, screaming and yelling. Again, I made careful note of the verbalizations. Pretty sure there were variations of "your mama" in there. The first official English Delton dictionary would not be suitable for all ages if I had a say in it. One of the Deltons, in an excess of zeal, hauled off and threw his pointy stick at the fleeing gorilloids. In one of those moments that changed the universe forever, the stick flew a trajectory that would make an Olympic decathlete proud and buried itself in the back of the neck of one of the targets. The animal fell over like it had been poleaxed and skidded face down to a full stop. The other two didn't even miss a step. The Delton Defense Force fell silent, and I discovered that slack-jawed amazement was probably a universal expression. A dozen Deltons stared at the dead gorilloid for several beats. Then a dozen Delton heads turned as one to stare at the spear chucker. Oh, please shrug. Oh, please let a shrug be in their repertoire. No such luck. I cataloged the ear movement as a probable shrug analog, swallowed my disappointment, and watched as the Deltons moved as a group toward the downed gorilloid. What did I miss? Marvin said as he appeared beside me. Just watch the replay. You will not believe this. The Delton spear chucker pulled his pointy stick from the dead gorilloid and poked it a few times. Getting no reaction, he turned to his friends and grinned. Not literally, of course, but I was getting used to interpreting the Delton expressions in human terms. They all started talking at once, jabbing the carcass and slapping and hugging each other. After a few minutes, they picked up the carcass and carried it back to camp.
Well, fair's fair, Marvin observed. I laughed. Now that's payback.
The Deltons ate well for the next few days, and gorilloids could be converted into many useful items, from hide strips to bone tools. The spear-chucking story was the hit of the campground. Deltons were just as prone as humans to act things out, and every retelling had a rapt audience. The spear-chucker got the lion's share of the gorilloid that he'd taken down, and an apparent large bump in status. He looked tired, but very happy. Archimedes was fascinated by the story as well. Anytime he saw or heard a retelling, he would run over to join the audience. Like many of the Deltons, he began to experiment with this technological innovation. The Deltons already understood throwing, but it seemed they'd never considered applying it to anything other than rocks. It was getting quite dangerous around the camp until some of the elders put their collective foot down. After much yelling and gesturing, the experimenters took their sticks outside the camp to practice. Unfortunately, even very straight, pointy sticks didn't fly dependably true. The spear chucker really had been lucky. Very few spears actually stuck into anything when thrown, and some of the Deltons had already given it up as a fad. Archimedes wasn't having any better luck with his spear chucking, but unlike the others, he took his pointy stick, sat down, and stared at it. I knew that look. I'd worn that look many times. He was working it out. It only took a few hours for Archimedes to find a flake about the right size, split the end of the pointy stick, and tie the flake onto it. The difference in weight wasn't much, but it moved the center of gravity forward of the grip point. That was all that was needed. The next time Archimedes threw the stick, it embedded itself in the ground in a most satisfactory manner. The other experimenters watched as Archimedes repeated the result twice more. After the third toss, one of the adults grabbed the spear and examined it. This resulted in another raucous town hall meeting. After Archimedes got his spear back, there was some further discussion. Then Archimedes headed off toward his cache with half the encampment following him. By this point, I was grinning like a fool. You go, boy. There was a lot more gabbling when Archimedes brought out his two remaining flint nodules. I think some people were angry with him for holding out. There was some pushing and shoving, and I readied the drone to bash some heads if necessary. We hadn't deployed the Buster drones yet, but I was quite prepared to sacrifice one of the light-duty units. I was certain that it would only take one to clear the room. Fortunately, it wasn't necessary. The Deltons that Archimedes had given the first good pointy sticks to, the largest members of the tribe, were firmly on his side, and the others seemed understandably reluctant to challenge them. One of the support group was a particularly impressive specimen that I had named Arnold. When Arnold leaned over an opponent and started yelling, there was generally very little further debate. Arnold made a gesture and said something that included "get" and the name that the Deltons used for Moses. Several Deltons ran off, and a few minutes later, Moses was escorted over. It looked like he was being hustled along a bit more quickly than he really found comfortable. I could pick up a few words, and I'm pretty sure Moses compared the members of his escort to pigoid droppings, smelly ones. To the extent I was able to follow the discussion, it sounded like Archimedes would volunteer his nodules to make spear points for everyone, and in return, he would get part